welcome to Not One Step Back with DDGO. I'm your host, Timmy, and today's segment will be on Scott Camille, the Winter Soldier. I'm joined here with today with Grant, my contributor. Thank you so much, Grant, for organizing this discussion.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. And did you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on today's topic and what this episode is specifically about?
Sure. So seeing as how we are approaching the 50th anniversary of the conclusion of the Vietnam War, we are having Scott Camille on the program. Scott is a prominent peace activist who rose to prominence through his participation in the Winter Soldier investigation, which was an expose on war crimes that were being committed in Vietnam at the time. Scott Camille himself was a Vietnam veteran, having served in Vietnam with the United States Marine Corps from 1965 to 1967. And upon returning home from the war and being exposed to the war lies that were being told about the war effort, gradually drifted towards being against the war. And seeing as how we are repeating a lot of the same actions that were committed by our government during the Vietnam War in relation to imperialism and warmongering and trying to contain countries like Russia and China, China in particular in the South Pacific region. His story and his warnings, therefore, serve as very pertinent messages in today's day and age.
Perfect. I'm so glad that we were able to get Scott on here, especially for our pilot. As you know, this is the first time that I'm going to be co-hosting, and I, you know, had the honor of meeting him last week on a discussion with all three of us about this episode and the filming of this episode. Do you want to let me know about how you and Scott actually met and what your background with him is?
Sure. So back when I was with the John Quincy Adams Society, I was putting on an event at my old university, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, in collaboration with the Unite America movement. And I was looking for a good guest speaker, and I recalled that as a freshman in high school, I watched the Winter Soldier investigation on YouTube. And for a kid like myself at that time, that documentary was life-changing for my worldview and how I think about things like geopolitics and military action abroad. It served as a stark warning about the dangers of things like wartime propaganda, of the consequences of imperialism and the atrocities that it brings. And as someone who grew up with a great respect for the veteran community, it caused me to realize that actually the best thing we can do for the veteran community is be against things like endless war and constant military adventurism around the globe. So it was from that memory of seeing Scott on that program that I decided to contact Scott. He agreed to do the event. And we have corresponded since then.
Perfect. Thank you so much once again. I'm really excited for Scott to share a bit about his journey. I know he has had a lot of experiences, especially in the last 50 years since the Vietnam War had ended officially. And I'm grateful to be able to discuss about his experience and his work along with, you know, the Vietnam Veterans for Peace movement and his experience with the Winter Soldier investigation, the Gainesville 8, and many other subtopics within the episode.
Looking forward to it.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much, Scott, for joining us here today. I know that you're a very busy man, so I just wanted to ask you, in order for the audience to know a little bit better about yourself, what's your origin story and what led you to join the Marine Corps and eventually get deployed to Vietnam?
Well, I grew up in a right-wing house. We flew an American flag from the house. My stepfather, who raised me since I was four, was a member of the John Birch Society, and he made recordings. So you would dial freedom on the telephone, and you'd get a recording about the communist conspiracy. And the main target of the recordings that he made was Martin Luther King, which he considered to be a communist. I was taught that I was lucky to have been born in the best country in the world, and that country was the United States of America, and I owed that country something. And what I owed that country as a male was military service. So I knew there were rules I had to follow growing up. I had to listen to my parents. I had to listen to the teachers. I had lots of rules like that. I had to graduate high school, and I knew that after high school, I would be going in the service. No one in my family had ever been to college, so college wasn't something that was even discussed. In high school, you have to write a career paper when you graduate. So I wrote my career paper on being a Marine, and I thought that the Marines were the best. And growing up in the 60s and 70s, for a male, macho was really important. Not showing feelings, not having any empathy, but just being a macho kind of individual. The motto of the Marine Corps at the time was "The Marine Corps builds men," and there's nothing I wanted more than to be considered a man. So I joined the Marine Corps.
Joining the Marine Corps and obviously sacrificing, for America was by going to war and joining the armed forces, right? What were your views about patriotism before and after the Vietnam War, and what were your views on patriotism now?
First, let me say that after I joined the Marines and I went through my training, I volunteered to go to Vietnam. It was really important to me to go to Vietnam, and I didn't know whether I was really a, quote, man or not. And I thought that I would find out when people started shooting at me. So that was really important to me. And I'm sorry, would you ask your question again?
Yeah, so what were some of your views on patriotism before the Vietnam War? And what were your views about patriotism afterwards? And kind of what has the past 50 years since then led you to your views of patriotism now?
So to me, patriotism meant loving one's country. And it was important to love your country, especially during the Cold War and growing up and learning. What I learned growing up was that the communists were trying to take over the world, and that in going to Vietnam, we could stop them over there before they got over here. So that sounded like a good idea to me. Let's stop them over there before they get over here. So I wanted to be patriotic. I loved my country. I was willing to make the sacrifices for that country. And patriotism included making sacrifices for your country. And that's what I thought about then. Now, I think that when I think about patriotism, the government was asking my generation to prove our patriotism by willing to go in the service, risk our lives, risk our mental health, risk our bodies for the best interest of the country, and to make those sacrifices. And now when I think about that, I think about why was it just the young men that had to prove their patriotism? You know, what about the rest of the country, especially the corporations that supplied the needs for us in Vietnam? Why were they allowed to make a profit? Those of us that were serving in Vietnam, we weren't there to make a profit. We were there to protect our country and show our patriotism. And the idea that while my friends were dying and I was laying in the mud bleeding, somebody was making a profit. And that just doesn't fit right in my brain. It's not proper as far as I'm concerned. So my views about what patriotism is and what patriotism should be changed.
How were you psychologically prepared by the Marine Corps for your deployment to Vietnam?
So to start with, how we weren't prepared was the fact that we were not taught anything about the culture of the Vietnamese. We were not taught any history about the war. All we were taught was we were going to go and stop communism. I'm sorry, ask your question again.
How were you psychologically prepared in your training for your deployment?
So psychologically, Marines are taught to believe that we're the toughest guys in the world, and we can kick anybody's ass. Every night we had to pray. So we'd get in our racks, we'd lay at attention in our racks, and then we would pray. And the prayer was, another day in the Corps, sir, for every day is a holiday and every meal is a feast. Pray for war. Pray for war. God bless our drill instructors. Pray for war. And we had to say that every night.
What caused you to turn against the war and join the peace movement?
I'm embarrassed to say that it took me much longer than it should have. Like I came back from Vietnam, I still had 2 years left in the Marine Corps, and I was training people to go to Vietnam. And then I got out of the Marine Corps, and I didn't really think about Vietnam. I thought about, what am I going to do? Like, my parents were always in charge of me. My teachers were in charge of me. The Marine Corps was in charge of me. I never been in charge of myself. Now I'm in charge of myself. Well, what am I going to do? So I knew I could get money if I went to school on the GI Bill. Nobody in my family had ever been to college. It had never been discussed, but I thought that I'd go to college. It'd be like an extension of high school, and I'd get money. And with that money, I could buy time to figure out what my future was going to be. I went to school. And then my professors knew that I had been a Vietnam veteran. And on campus, there were people who were against the war. And I didn't like those people. They wore black armbands, and I thought that they were cowards and communist sympathizers. And I'd wear my Marine Corps tropical jacket, and I'd walk down the halls, and when I see somebody in a black armband, I'd smash into them, you know, with my shoulder, always trying to pick a fight. Never once did I ask them why they thought how they thought. Then one day, one of my professors said, you know, Scott, we're the aggressors in Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh was our ally in World War II, and we promised Vietnam independence. But when the war was over, we immediately released Japanese prisoners and British soldiers and American soldiers and Japanese prisoners who were now rearmed, went after Ho Chi Minh's soldiers and to wipe out Ho Chi Minh. And I didn't really understand, like, why would that be? Why would we break our word? What's more important than our word? We made a promise to him. And so the readings that my professor gave me and those kind of questions got me to start thinking about it. And then in January of 1971, I think, it might have been 72, I can't remember, Jane Fonda came to speak at the University of Florida. So I went to see her. I didn't really go to listen to what she had to say. I just went to see her because she was a movie star. There were tons of people there, and she was on a platform on a pond, and I was up on a hill, and I could see a little speck, which was her, but I could hear her talking. But I was smoking a joint, and I was playing Frisbee with my friends, and I was just not really paying attention. And then somehow her words captured me, and she said, "We lived in a democracy. And in order for a democracy to function, the public had to have access to the truth." And she said that the public was being lied to by the government about the nature of the war in Vietnam. And she said it was the duty of patriotic Vietnam veterans to tell the public what was really being done in their name with their money. And those words captured me. And I thought, well, I believe in democracy. I believe the public has the right to know the truth. I know for sure what I'm reading in the newspapers and seeing on TV and on the radio isn't the truth. I'm patriotic. I believe in democracy. So I went forward and said that I was willing to talk about what's going on in Vietnam. So they took my name. They asked me what branch of service I was in and what my rank was. And that's all they asked me. And then I got a phone call a few days later from Michael Oliver, and he asked me, he said a bunch of Vietnam veterans were getting together to testify about what they did in Vietnam, and would I be willing to come and testify? And I said, well, I'm poor. How am I supposed to go to Detroit? And he said, well, we'll send you a plane ticket. So I said, okay, I'll go. Part of my motivation wasn't really just to educate the public, but it was also for me. Like when I was growing up, I saw after World War II, there were parades and all kinds of thanks for the veterans. Where was our parades? Where was our thanks? And we didn't have any of that. So I was upset about that. So I thought that I would go to this Winter Soldier investigation and maybe I'd get some thanks for my service there. So then I went there. And when I first got there, they were vetting people. They were checking their DD-214s, which is a form you get when you get out of the service that says you were in the service, what branch of service you were in, how long you were there, what kind of medals you won, and those kind of things. So I presented, I came to the table to present my documentation, and the guy sitting at the table was a person, his name was Ken Campbell. And he was the person who took my job in Vietnam. So he recognized me and says, hey, Scott, I remember you. And we started talking about a village that had been wiped out in Quang Tri. So that was my introduction to Winter Soldier. I'm on a panel of the first Marines. They asked questions. I answered the questions that they asked. Had they said, tell us about Vietnam, my testimony would have been a little bit different. I don't know what I would have really talked about. But at the hearings, they were focused on the bad things that we were doing. So those were the questions that they asked us, and those were the questions that I answered. Those hearings lasted for 3 days. So I got to hear other veterans testifying about what they did. And all I really knew was what I did and what I saw in my unit from the time that I was there. But the Vietnam War was 10 years long. And so they had veterans testifying who were there when I wasn't there and who were there from other branches of the service. And I got the ability to learn about, wow, what's going on in all of Vietnam. They called a meeting after the 3 days of testimony of all the veterans that testified. So we went in a room and we sat in this room. Mike Oliver says, well, you've heard for 3 days what's going on. What are we going to do about this? So at that meeting, we decided to form Vietnam Veterans Against the War as a national organization. It had already existed as an organization in six northeastern states. So we made Vietnam Veterans Against the War a national organization, and those of us that testified became what was called regional coordinators. And I became the regional, and there were 28 of us, I became the regional coordinator for Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. So it was my job to start organizing Vietnam Veterans Against the War chapters in Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. At the same time, Playboy magazine gave us a free full-page ad. They've got tons of responses, tens of thousands of responses. So I received a list of all of the names, phone numbers, and addresses of the people in Florida, Alabama, and Georgia that wanted to organize. So this was before we had computers. So all of this stuff I'm talking about now, we did by telephone. Letters. So things were a little bit slower than normal. And back then, you didn't just pick up the telephone to make a call. You had to pay for each long distance call. So it was expensive to call people and discuss those things. So I sent a copy to each major city in my region, places like Atlanta, Montgomery, Alabama, Miami, Florida, Orlando, Jacksonville, Tallahassee. So I would send all of the veterans in each one of those cities a letter with a list and contact information for all the other veterans in that city. And I'd say, get in touch with each other, organize, and once you're organized, contact me, give me a call, and I'll come to your city and I'll help you get organized. And so that took place. And then I started going to the different cities and helping the coordinators of the different cities organize Winter Soldier investigations in those cities, because I was so moved by Winter Soldier investigation, I thought, this is perfect. We'll have people hearing from their own sons, their own fathers, their own brothers about what they did in Vietnam, and that would have much more of an impact than strangers talking about the war. So I started doing those organizations. I started getting arrested. And I was really surprised because unlike most Americans who were born here, we all inherited the rights guaranteed to us under the Constitution. But I didn't just inherit those rights. I signed my name on a piece of paper and said, I'm willing to fight and die for those rights. And then I went to Vietnam and I was wounded twice. I spilled blood on the ground. And so I felt I deserved those rights. I worked for those rights. I bled for those rights. And it made me very adamant about it. And it made me very angry at the government who was trying to shut us up. I became an organizer for Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I organized protests and demonstrations. I started getting arrested. And what was really happening was the government, before we came along, they were saying, oh, the people against the war in Vietnam, they're communist sympathizers. They're cowards. They're people not willing to serve their country. They're people that don't even know what they're talking about. Well, they couldn't say that about us. You know, I wasn't reading about Vietnam. I was the foreign policy. I was carrying it out. We were very adamant about what we were doing. And if we were willing to fight for our rights in Vietnam, why wouldn't we be willing to fight for our rights in the United States?
When you hear the former FBI director in 1971, J. Edgar Hoover, send a memo to the Jackson police, and it says, in referring to you, Camille is an extremely dangerous and unstable individual whose activities must be neutralized as early as possible time. What do you think he meant by neutralize, and what were some feelings with that came with that statement?
Well, first of all, if they considered me dangerous, who trained me to be dangerous? You know, they trained me. So they knew whether they considered me dangerous or not. And of course, if you're trained in combat and then you experience combat and have combat skills. When I read that I was targeted to be neutralized, that really upset me. Like what right did they have to do that? And I didn't, I was very upset about that. But on the other hand, I felt that if I go and mow my yard, I put a few hours in, I mow it, and then I look and it's pretty and it smells good and I get positive reinforcement for my energy and I feel good. When you're working against the war, it keeps going on. More people are dying. Nixon got reelected and said he was going to end the war, and then 20,000 more Americans died. So my initial being against the war wasn't because I cared about the Vietnamese. It was because I didn't think more Americans should be dying for that war. The fact that the government wanted to kill me, that's what neutralize means, to shut me up, that really offended me. But it also was positive reinforcement, because I felt, well, if I wasn't making an impact, they wouldn't care. But the fact that they care means I must be making an impact. And so the more they tried to intimidate me, the more energy they gave me. So their intimidation had the opposite effect that they were hoping for. Then eventually federal agents came to Gainesville. One of them held me like this. The other one put a gun to my back. The bullet went in behind my heart and came out my stomach. As you can see, I survived. But how I feel about it is that I was wounded twice in Vietnam defending the Constitution. Then I was wounded once when I came home and exercised those rights that I had fought for.
You know, you mentioned that you were shot twice in Vietnam and once in America. What led to being shot on your own soil? What happened there?
So, first of all, I wasn't shot twice in Vietnam. The first time I was wounded was by a bouncing Betty, which is a kind of mine that shoots up in the air, gets about 8 feet, and explodes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The second time I was wounded, somebody dropped a grenade on me from a tree. A North Vietnamese threw a grenade at me, and I was wounded from that grenade.
Mm-hmm.
When I came home was the only time that I got shot. And I'm sorry, you can ask your question again.
Sure. You mentioned that you were wounded twice in Vietnam and once in America. What led to being shot on your own soil? What led up to that?
All I can really tell you is what happened to me. What really led up to it, I just assume that the government wanted to shut me up. There was that neutralized memo that's obvious to me that they wanted to shut me up. How they came to that conclusion, I don't really know. But what happened was one day I got a knock at my door, and there's this really pretty girl. She was looking for somebody else who didn't live there. But I said she could come in and use my telephone. So she came in the house to use the telephone. We smoked some marijuana. We snorted some cocaine. We had sex. And I thought, wow, life's great. So she became a girlfriend. What I didn't know was she worked for the FBI, and they were targeting me to shoot me, and it was her job to set that up. So one day she told me that two of her friends were coming into Gainesville, and could I get a gram of coke for her? I went with so her two friends came over, picked me up. They were both federal agents. I didn't know that. We went to get some coke, while we were in the car, the one agent sitting in the back seat grabbed me around the neck, pulled my head to the headrest, stuck a gun in my head, and he said, if you move, I'm going to blow off your fucking head. And he started beating me with the gun. Well, I'm a Marine. I've been in combat. I'm not going to just sit there and let you beat me. So I grabbed the wrist with the gun. I pinned the wrist and the gun to the top of the car inside. I reached around with my left hand. I unlocked the door because I thought they were trying to rob me for my $50. I didn't know who they really were. I was going to jump out in the traffic. So the driver hit the brakes of the car. We all went forward. The driver took his hands off the steering wheel, grabbed my other hand and pulled it back like that. And then the guy with the gun got his hand loose and he shot me. The impact of the bullet, because the door was opened, knocked me out into the street. I got a gash in my leg from hitting the street so hard. And then the guy that shot me jumped on top of me and stuck the gun in my face. And just then the police pulled up and they arrested him and the driver. And then later it turned out that they were both federal agents. The police station was about 3 blocks from where this occurred. So the police were there right away. I went to the hospital, the agents went to jail. And then over time, the agents were released. I had a jury trial. The jury found me not guilty. And not only did they find me not guilty, but the jury recommended to the judge that the agents be indicted for attempted murder. Nothing happened to the agents.
Wow.
About our government, that they are so fearful of returning veterans telling the truth about the nature of U.S. intervention overseas.
Was that a question?
Oh, yeah. My apologies. I was just wondering, what do you think that says about our federal government? That they are so fearful of the people serving our country coming home and basically telling the truth about the nature of these wars that we're fighting overseas.
So I think that obviously the government doesn't want the public to know the truth. And back then what they did is they shot me to teach me a lesson, so they thought. But they've also changed their policy. And now people in the military have to sign secrecy agreements where they agree not to tell what they did under penalty of law. So now you have people coming back who are afraid to talk about what they really did or what they really saw because they don't want to be arrested.
Timmy, would you like to transition to discussing the Gainesville 8 situation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think discussing that as the last chunk for this video, and then we'll make another video and we'll discuss a little bit about the testimonies and what happened with Winter Soldier investigation as well. So yeah, so one of the questions that I really have is, can you describe the situation in regards to the Gainesville 8 and what happened there?
Well, at Winter Soldier, we formed Vietnam Veterans Against the War, a national organization, I became the regional coordinator for Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And so the regional coordinator is responsible for all activities and demonstrations in that region. So the Republican Party and the Democratic Party decided to have their 1972 conventions in Miami Beach, Florida. Miami Beach was in my region, so that became my responsibility to plan for, all kinds of planning for getting permits for the demonstrations. I met with the Miami Police Department, the Miami Beach Police Department. We had a softball game with the police department to get to know each other and to be friends. I've sort of lost my train of thought. Say the question again.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, can you describe the situation in regards to the Gainesville 8? What happened in terms of coming about to that?
Okay, so now the conventions are going to be in Miami Beach, and I'm organizing the conventions. I'm meeting with the police. I also met with two right-wing Cuban organizations, Abdallah and Alpha 66. And I went down and I met with who I thought were the leaders of those organizations. And the man that I met with, who was a member of Alpha 66 and Abdallah, turned out to be an undercover FBI guy who was infiltrated those organizations. And his name was Pablo. His name will come to me. Pablo Fernandez. So I had a meeting with him, I went to that meeting with another coordinator named William Lemmer. Well, William Lemmer was also FBI. As it turned out, that I learned later, a lot of times I was at meetings where I was the only person who wasn't an undercover agent. And the FBI, the Secret Service, the Treasury Department, the Miami Beach Police Department, the Miami Police Department, Dade County Public Safety Department, there were 17 agencies that infiltrated my organization. And those agencies didn't trust each other, so they didn't share information with each other. So they didn't know. And that was really great. It was really great because what happened is at the trial of the Gainesville 8, the agents had to stick to their original statements. So I'm at a meeting. So it's me, person A, B, and C. So person A goes back to their agency and says, Scott Camille and Mr. B and C are planning on doing this bad thing. Agent B goes back to his agency and says, Scott Camille and A and C are planning this bad thing. And Agent C goes back to his department and tells them that Scott Camille and A and B are planning this thing. And so those were their original statements. And in court, there's something called Jenks Act material, and they have to turn that stuff over to us. So they chopped each other up on the witness stand because they had to stick to those original statements. And that clearly showed that they were provocateurs. They were people who suggested doing things that were unlawful. And it turned out that what they were trying to get was something called an overt act. And so when you charge somebody with a crime of conspiracy, it has to be an agreement between two or more people to commit an illegal act. That's the first part. And the second part is there has to be an occurrence in furtherance of that plan, which is called an overt act, in order for them to charge you. They used each other's testimony and meetings as overt acts to indict me in the Gainesville 8 case. That trial went on for about 30 days. The government called 28 witnesses. After the government rested, then it's our turn to put on a defense. And we had internal arguments about what that defense would be. So, of the defendants, there were eight of us. The lawyers said, look, the government hasn't proven anything. The jury has been locked up. They've been sequestered for a month away from their families. They want to see their families. They're getting tired of being locked up. The longer we keep them locked up, the less chance there is for them to fight for us if there's a disagreement when they're trying to decide on the verdict. So the lawyers wanted to rest our case without putting on a defense. Of the eight of us, six people agreed with the lawyers and two of them didn't. I was one of the two that didn't. I felt that we had international press. All the press was there. Now it's our turn to tell the story about what we really did in Vietnam, to talk about search and destroy operations, to talk about body count, to talk about Agent Orange, to talk about all those kind of things. And so the vote was 6-2 against us putting on a defense. So I was very angry about that. And I didn't speak to the other guys for a bunch of years over that, because it really pissed me off. So we rested our case without putting on the defense. And a few hours later, we had the closing statements. And a few hours later, the jury came back not guilty on all charges. That was the Gainesville 8 case.
I guess their incompetency was very helpful in terms of the verdict and such, right? I am curious. I know that it only took a couple minutes to actually make the verdict. What did that feel like?
Well, I've had 3 jury trials. And I would say that in some instances, it's more traumatic than being in combat.
Scott, I would like to ask, what were your thoughts regarding the prospect of giving testimony at the Winter Soldier investigation prior to you actually doing it?
Well, I didn't really have any thoughts because I really didn't know anything about it. I hadn't heard of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I hadn't heard of the Winter Soldier investigation. So I just thought I was going to go there and we were going to talk about Vietnam. And I didn't know what part of Vietnam they wanted to talk about. I didn't have a clue.
What were some of the testimonies that were made by the combat veterans?
Well, for me, what it did is I got to see what happened in Vietnam when I wasn't there, what happened in Vietnam when I was there in mm-hmm. other units. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see a much broader picture. And also, there were Vietnamese that testified about their treatment. There were POWs that testified about their treatment. There were Black veterans that talked about the racism in the military, which I'd never even thought about. So there was a lot of issues that was discussed. In my mind, before I went there, Vietnam was my experience. And now I went to Winter Soldier, and I got to see Vietnam as lots of other people's experience. There were a lot more things going on besides what I was doing, you know, mm-hmm. especially in terms of racism and those kind of issues. So it was an education for me also.
You know, there's so many, things that happened in terms of horrific things that had happened during Vietnam. You know, the public found out about the napalms and, you know, the massacres of like innocent civilians, the mass rapes of, you know, Vietnamese women and such. What were some of the things that you were surprised about that you heard that you didn't know before?
I guess in general, I didn't think about how Black veterans felt about their treatment, the jobs they got, and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think about the POWs. And at Winter Soldier, there was an American POW who testified about his treatment. There were Vietnamese POWs that testified about their treatment from us. Going into Winter Soldier, I still had no empathy for the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. But coming out of Winter Soldier, I gained empathy, and it was from hearing all the stuff that I wasn't really aware of, that I wasn't really thinking about, because before that I was just thinking about my experience.
I mean, you were conditioned to have these, images in your head about the Vietnamese and these ideas, right? What were some of the things that they taught you in terms of how to deal with the Viets in their own nation.
So we weren't really taught anything about their culture. We weren't taught anything about their language, anything like that. So here I am, you know, and I had my 20th and 21st birthdays in Vietnam. So I'm just a kid. I'm 19 years old, and I'm going to question Vietnamese. We captured the Vietnamese. I want to know something. So I start asking them questions. They don't speak English. And then I would get mad because they wouldn't answer the questions. Like I'd say, "Where'd the VC go?" And they'd say, "Cambiak." And I'd say, "Where'd the fucking VC go?" And they'd say, "Cambiak." And that means I don't understand. Well, but at the time, I didn't know that that meant they didn't understand. I thought they were just giving me hard times. I would be harmful to them. I would hit them, I would kick them, I would shoot them, I would do whatever I wanted to do. And for my unit in general, we didn't take prisoners. People talk about the rules of war. And I would say that how could there be rules of war? If there's rules, why wouldn't the first rule be we're going to solve our problems without murdering each other? You know, this idea that's rules, when your life is on the line, if your life is on the line, would you break a rule to save your life? Of course you would. Who wouldn't? We did. And I did what I thought was necessary to stay alive, to protect my friends, and to kill the enemy. That's the whole reason I was there. And we measured our success by body count, who could kill the most people. And when you'd kill somebody, they automatically became a Viet Cong because we didn't kill civilians. So you'd shoot somebody and you'd radio in three dead VC, and someone would say, "How do you know they're VC?" And I would say, "They're dead." And that was sufficient.
And you were so
what were
young,
your thoughts
right?
On
You were so young in terms of like being in your early 20s. It wasn't even necessary to condition you. You were so young and impressionable. You were in this foreign nation, and your mindset was to survive, right? So what were some of the main factors that told you that you really needed to survive whilst in Vietnam?
Well, so I got there in March of 1966, the end of March. On April 18th, 1966, I was in a unit called Alpha North. And because I was a new guy in that unit, I was put on guard duty. And we had four outposts, and each outpost had four Marines in it, two Marines inside who would sleep, and two Marines who would sit on top of the bunker. Each bunker had a 50 caliber machine gun, an M60 machine gun, automatic M14s, Claymore mines, and grenades. So on the night of April 18th, I'm on guard on top of the bunker. And we have what's called rules of engagement. And I was violating the rules. So the rules say that you're not allowed to have your weapon loaded. And the rules say that you can't fire without permission. But in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm in Vietnam. I'm getting combat pay. People are getting killed. Why wouldn't I have my rifle loaded? You know, and if I see an enemy, why do I have to ask someone permission to shoot them? I'm a person who tends to think for themselves, which got me in trouble a lot. And so I'm atop of the bunker, and all of a sudden, to my left front, a trip flare went off. So these are flares that are buried in the ground. And when somebody trips one, the flare shoots up in the sky, it lights up, and you can see everything. And so the flare went off, and it makes a sound. And it draws your attention. And as soon as it went off, I saw all of these Viet Cong sappers, and they had already come through our fence. And so what I'm going to say now all happened that quick. The trip flare went off. I saw the sappers coming in, At the same time, three of the four bunkers blew up. Mine was the only one that didn't blow up. And the reason that my bunker didn't blow up was because it wasn't guarding anything. So there were two bunkers. So picture a square outpost, and in each corner, a unit, and in each corner is a bunker. And so the front two bunkers covered the artillery pieces, and were to guard the front and the artillery pieces. Over on the west side was the ammo dump and the fuel dump. So that front bunker and the back bunker on that side was to guard that. On my side, there was nothing there. It was near where the mess hall was. So there was no fuel, there was no ammo, there was no guns, there was nothing that the enemy really wanted. So luckily, they didn't attack my bunker heavily. They just shot at my bunker, but they didn't blow it up. And then the enemy penetrated our compound on three sides, the front and two sides, and they blew up what they wanted to blow up, and they shot people, and out of 80 of us, actually I think there were 79, we had 5 men killed, 28 men wounded, and the enemy left 40 dead behind. And that was my first battle. It was a very intense battle. And when I first got into the unit, people say, "Hey, man, where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from Florida." They said, "Hey, Maine is from Florida." So he was my first friend in the unit, and his name was Maine, and his last name was Maine. He was on a front bunker by the guns. So as soon as the fighting started, I saw his bunker blow up, and then I saw the Viet Cong sappers on top of his bunker shooting the Marines. But I was busy defending my bunker, and I couldn't shoot across the compound to his bunker because I might hit Marines. So I saw that. The enemy did what they wanted to do, and they dissipated. And then in the morning, the infantry came to reinforce us. And then we brought the dead Marines and the wounded Marines to the front. We brought the dead Viet Cong to the front. We brought all of the ammo and stuff that the Viet Cong had to the front. We went through their pockets looking for maps and intelligence information, and all of that stuff went to the front. So the infantry is there now. I went to the front, and there were the dead Marines laying there, and they had ponchos laying over them. And I went and I pulled the poncho over each one's face to see who they were. And one of them was my friend Maine. And I was really surprised. And I looked at him, and he was dead. And I thought, wow, I live in this place where it's people's job to kill me. And they're allowed to do that. And there's no time out. There's no King's X. There's no give me a second chance. If they kill me, I'm going to be dead. And I don't want to be dead. So I decided at that moment, looking at my dead friend, that I would have no empathy, and that I would kill as many Vietnamese as I could. And since I couldn't tell the good ones from the bad ones, fuck all of them. Let God sort them out. That's what we would say. Kill them all. Let God sort them out. And that's who I became.
What was your reaction upon reuniting with Ken Campbell at the Winter Soldier investigation for the first time since Vietnam?
Well, we didn't work together in Vietnam. He replaced me and took my job, but it's always nice when you go to something new, and there's somebody who you know who knows how the system there works and befriends you and helps you. So it was really great to see Ken. It was just really great. It was great for both of us, and we're still friends today.
Why did you get to see Ken after so long? What was the purpose of that?
Well, he was working with Vietnam Veterans Against the War, And one of his jobs was to vet the people that were coming in. So the people coming in saying, "I'm a veteran. I want to participate." Well, prove you're a veteran. Where's your proof? And the proof is in the form called a DD-214. So you hand that person the form, and they look at the form. They ask you for an ID card so they can see that you're the person who has the DD-214. You're the same person. You're not somebody else that has somebody else's DD-214. To see someone who already knew me and already knew that I'd been in Vietnam for real because he saw me there, it was just it was it made me feel much more comfortable about this thing I had just stepped into that I didn't know anything about.
What was the hardest part about testifying at the Winter Soldier investigation?
So I don't really know that there was a hard part. You can see from talking to me now, I've always been like this. You ask me a question, I'm going to be straightforward and answer it. But when I reflect back on Vietnam, and the memories and the nightmares I sometimes have, I would say that the part that I remember the most and that traumatizes me the most, if you will, was a scene in a place called Dai Lok. I was with the lieutenant, his radio operator, me, and my radio operator. We're on an operation, and we come onto this scene. And on the scene, there's four Marines, and they've just finished raping a Viet Cong nurse. And not only did they rape her, but they also mutilated her. So they slit her breasts. They stuck several tree branches up her vagina and up her anus. She was still alive when we came up on her. And the lieutenant saw this scene, and he started yelling and screaming at these four Marines. The woman was asking for water. She kept saying, "Nook, nook," that means water. So I bent down, and I took the cap off my canteen, and I'm giving her a drink of water. The lieutenant's yelling at the Marines, and then over the radio, the captain's yelling at the lieutenant, "What's taking you so long? Get your asses up here!" So the lieutenant says, "We've got to move out, kill her." And the four Marines who were involved in this event, none of them would do it. And so then the lieutenant looked at me and said, "Artie, killer." And they called me Artie because I was a artillery FO, forward observer, and that's how they referred to me. So when they needed me, they'd say Artie up, and that meant I'd come up to where they wanted me. And so I looked her in the eye, I put a gun to her head, and I shot her. And then we moved on. And so she was looking me in the eye when I shot her. I would say that's probably the most troubling event. I think what I did was put her out of her misery, but I still, my soul has been touched.
Years later, with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, another Winter Soldier investigation was set up, with these conflicts eerily echoing the Vietnam War. What are your thoughts about more contemporary versions of the Winter Soldier investigation?
So I went and helped in the organization of the testimony of the Iraq and Afghan soldiers. And when we did Winter Soldier, we didn't have World War II guys or Korean soldiers saying, "Hey, you're doing a good job. We really need this. Thank you." What we had is the country saying, "We're the bad guys." Going to their Winter Soldier and giving them hugs and encouraging them and telling them they're doing the right thing and the public has the right to know these things, it was good for them. And it was also good for me.
What's one of the main messages that you want to send out to people with all the work that you've done, especially people who are as young as myself and Grant, who never experienced, living through Vietnam and, probably don't know as much as those who went through it during that era?
So there's just a lot of things that are really important. I think it's important to understand who is the main authority in the United States of America. It's not the president, it's not the Congress, it's not the Supreme Court, it's the people. And the Congress and the Supreme Court and the president are public servants. They are our employees. We are the employers. It is our job to monitor our employees. It's our job to make sure that they are doing what we want them to do. And it's our job to let them know, to thank them when they're doing what we like, and to let them know we don't like what they're doing when we don't like it. If we don't do that job, they have the right to think what they're doing is okay. It's our job to make sure they know what we want. And that's really, really important. We are the supreme authority.
What can
Do
young
you
people
have?
do in terms of getting involved with, activism and, these anti-imperialist activities?
Well, that's just part of my job. My government's doing these activities in my name with my tax money. It's not okay with me. And so it's my job. Living in a democracy comes with a responsibility. And that responsibility is to keep your government in check. And we don't have people doing that anymore. The Supreme Court under Roberts has said, money is free speech, so they've allowed money to come in, and the billionaires get to buy the politicians they want, and those politicians are answerable to the billionaires, not to the public. So they've stolen our responsibility away from us, and they've negated our responsibility by making us unnecessary for the politicians. They don't need us. They get their money from the billionaires. So why do they have to listen to us?
Do you have any words of warning for our leaders in today's day and age? Because it seems that we're stepping into a lot of the same problems that we stepped into during the Cold War with the proxy wars and saber rattling with Russia and China.
I would call it bullying. We're really bullies. And we bully other countries. And if those countries allow us to use their resources, then they're our friends. If those countries want to protect their resources, they become our enemies. If the those countries vote along with us in the UN and places like that, they're our friends. If those countries stand up to us, they're our enemies. The truth and justice doesn't play any role in all of that. If you don't have truth and justice, what do you have? It's propaganda. It's just, I remember when my grandparents were telling me about our relatives that died in the concentration camps. I'm Jewish. My relatives told us about how other relatives were rounded up and went to the concentration camps. And I didn't really understand how could that be. Well, where were their next door neighbors? How did the public allow that to happen? My grandmother would say, "You just don't understand." And that's true. I didn't understand. But now I see it happening in my country. And I see it happening again. And now it's my generation's time to do something about it. And I see that we have demonstrations, we write our congressman, a congressperson, we vote, we do all kinds of stuff, but it doesn't seem like they care because they're funded by an other source, and they're going to be doing what that other source wants them to do. And so we talk about this being a democracy, but it's not really a democracy. It's a plutocracy, and the rich run the show.
What are your thoughts when you see people of Timmy and I, our generation, advocate against things like imperialism?
Well, I think it's so important, and it makes me happy because I can't do everything myself, and people of my generation, like I'm 70, I'm going to be 79 in May. We're getting old. We're dying off. We really need the next generation to step in our shoes and to continue the fight against imperialism and genocide and the kind of things that we're involved in. And so I already know from my years of efforts, there's not a lot of positive reinforcement. And so to see young people who say, I'm going to do what's right, even though I'll get criticized, even though I'm not going to make any money, but I believe in democracy and I believe in doing the right thing and I'm going to stand up for peace and justice, it's encouraging. It's very encouraging. So I'm thankful to you.
Thank
Well, I'll
you.
Say this: it is an honor to take up to do our part. You know, it's the people of your generation who stood up against imperialism were trailblazers for people of our generation as and in the evolving landscape. So it is an honor to and we have to, you know, pay homage and. To what your generation started, you know, all those decades ago.
Well, let me just say that my generation didn't really start it. There were people that demonstrated against World War II. There were people that demonstrated against Korea. There were people in organizations like the Lincoln Brigade that stood up and went to Spain and fought against fascism before World War II. I'm following in their footsteps.
I guess it's
so
a
I had
matter
a
for
really
all
good
of us.
I had a really good friend. He's passed away now, and his name was Jack Penrod, and he was a World War II veteran, and he fought in the Lincoln Brigade, and he became a member of my chapter of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and he talked to us all about how hard it was for them way back then to fight these things and how we have to carry this fight on and why should it even be a fight? Like why shouldn't they have to fight to make wars instead of have to fight to stop wars?
If we are to make war unattractive or make war less likely, what do you think should be done to limit the possibility, especially in the today's current day and age of things like nuclear proliferation and whatnot?
So there's two things that I think are really important. one of them is there shouldn't be profit allowed in war. If we're asking our young people to risk their lives, to risk their mental health, to risk their limb, to show their patriotism, why don't the corporations have to show their patriotism by giving up their profit, just like we have to give up our futures, and to supply the needs that are necessary for us to achieve this objective? If this objective is so important for our country, why aren't they making a sacrifice for a country just like the young women, men and women are? So I think that that's really important. Two things I want to say. The behavior of war. War is an institution made up of criminal behavior, behavior that outside of the institution of war is criminal. Why would we allow criminal behavior? And you know, like I remember my parents, I'm the oldest of four kids, and the kids would fight over what TV show we're going to watch, or you know, who gets to use the bathroom first, or whatever we fought over. My parents would say, be an adult. Adults don't solve their problems by fighting. And that was the message. And then we look at the country, and that's how they solve their problems. It's hard to teach children one behavior when the country is showing another behavior that's opposite of what your parents are trying to teach you. I think that understanding the criminality and the criminal nature of war, that it's important that we not reinforce that behavior.
Timmy, do you have any topics, items that are pertinent?
Yeah, I think one of the questions that I have were, what are some works that you've done in the past while that have really influenced you? Along with, of course, like Winter Soldier and, you know, the Gainesville Eight, what other works have really influenced your decision making of moving forward with the peace movement?
Well, I think the important thing is knowing who to believe when you hear facts about stuff. Who's telling the truth? So one of the things that I've been able to do, which I'm really grateful to, is to go on fact-finding missions to other countries. And so I can come home and report on what we're really doing there. I've been to, during our wars against the people of Central America, I went to Guatemala, I went to Nicaragua, I went to Honduras, I got to meet the Sandinistas, I got to hear their points of view, I got to see for myself what was really going on in those countries, as opposed to what my government was saying. And one of the most important ones for me, besides Central America, was going to the Middle East. I'm Jewish, I wouldn't believe the things that I heard as far as the treatment of the Palestinians. And people would say, Scott, you do all this good work, but you support Israel. And I'd say, well, I'm Jewish. What do you expect? Israel wouldn't do all those things. I know Jews. They don't act like that. So they say, how do you like to go and see? So all my life, my aunt, my uncle, my grandparents, my parents, their greatest wish was to go see Israel, and none of them got to go. I was offered a chance to go, so I jumped on that, and I went. And then I couldn't believe the things that I saw. And I came back from Israel, and also I was in Palestine, and I was in the West Bank, and I was in Gaza, and I got to see what was going on in those places. And I came back supporting Palestinian rights. And that really upset the members of my family. My mother didn't talk to me for 10 years over that, because there's this unwritten rule that Jews don't criticize Israel. A good Jew doesn't criticize Israel. But to me, a good Jew tells the truth. I was blown away by the things that I saw, and I came back and I worked against what's going on, and I'm still very involved in the Palestinian rights and against the genocide and ethnic cleansing that's taking place that my tax money is paying for.
I'm sure you've heard so many times in your life that, you know, you are a traitor to, you know, your identity and your nation. But to me, it seems as if you really are the authentic, you know, definition of what it means to be a patriot. If anything, you are probably the utmost Jewish American patriot that there is, right? And I want to thank you for all the work that you've done in, you know, the span of decades, probably years before then we were born, right? And it's really an inspiration to see this. And, you know, this discussion is going to allow me to move forward and, figure out how I want to, have my own anti-imperialist work and any other work moving forward that actually really supports, veterans and such.
So when I look in the mirror, I want to be able to like that person that I see. I want to be able to respect that person that I see. And so the things that I do help me with that, help me be able to respect myself and like what I'm doing, as opposed to the things that I did before that I liked at the time, like seeing how many Vietnamese I could kill, that now I see the wrong of. And I think one of the things that's really important, and one of the things that's really, really hard for a lot of people, especially Americans, and I don't really know why, is to admit a mistake and to change their behavior. So if I'm doing something and you can show me why it's wrong, why wouldn't I stop doing it? Why wouldn't I change my behavior? But Americans aren't really good at admitting mistakes and changing their behavior. They'll continue doing something wrong because of that. And I don't really have an understanding of why that is. Like, why am I able to do it, but other people can't? I don't know. I don't get it. I don't understand it.
I'm sure you've influenced so many people. I know you've influenced myself, and I'm sure Grant as well. I want to thank you once again for everything that you've done, and I hope, we can once again speak in another discussion and speak more about Vietnam and, your experience and such moving forward, because I do think that your experience and your work has really impacted a lot of people's lives, and I know it's impacted myself. So thank you so much once again for everything. I really appreciated it.
So you're very much welcome. And let me say that I've spoken in so many college classes and so many high school classes, and my wife and I will be at the store shopping, and somebody will come up to me and say, "You spoke in my class 10 years, and that changed my life." That has a lot of impact on me. It makes me feel, it rewards me for my efforts.
I'm glad it does, because it's definitely deserved. And I'm grateful to be able to learn everything today, because I didn't know as much as I did, and you painting that picture has always been, very much an honor. And once again, thank you.
And I don't know if you guys have seen yet the new documentary, Vietnam, the War That Changed America, by 72 Films out of London. It's a 6-part series. It's just the most fantastic thing I've ever seen on Vietnam. And I'm in episode 5. So I hope that you guys can view that and look at that. That would be really important to me that you guys looked at that.
100%. I would love to even discuss further in other discussions, maybe that we could host another time about more of your work, because I think that that's important, like highlighting and such. That'd be great.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I'm here. I'm available.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good one. I know that this is going to end soon, so.
If you guys ever come to Florida, you better come visit me.
100%.
Will
Will
do.
Do.
It's great to see you again, Scott.
Thank you so much.
Have a good one.